I'm Kevin Davis, and this is the Catholic Family Podcast. And well, today we're very happy to be joined by a very frequent visitor to the podcast, that is Intro Ebo. But today, he's actually not going to talk about our usual topic, the kind of the dark, dreary, depressing stuff, you know, the going into the occult, which I still find to be extremely interesting and valuable so that people know what kind of the bad that's out there. But today we're going to talk about something a little more, well, I consider a lot more, what's the word? I guess, optimistic, good. I think we'll leave today's show feeling better about the world than we did coming into it. And today, Intro Ebo is going to tell us about more about Father DePaul. Now, we actually, the first ever show we did with Intro Ebo was about Father DePaul. You can go back. I'll try to link that in this show. So it was kind of a brief introduction of who he was and how Intro Ebo knew him. But today, Intro Ebo is going to go into three stories in particular that kind of, let us know a little bit more about this great priest. And I think when the world looks back on the history of today, what is now the church in the last 60 years of what's gone on in the Catholic Church, because we all know that the Catholic Church is going to succeed. We know that it will prevail. And when the church looks back on that, and history looks back on that, they're going to see a handful of men and women who saved it, truly. As we see, St. Athanasius, and others throughout the ages, in this era of the 1960s until now, there are a handful of men and women who I think will look back and say they are the ones who kept the church alive. And I think that Father DePaul is absolutely going to be one of them. I'm not saying he's a saint. I certainly hope he's in heaven. I think Intro Ebo would absolutely echo that as well. But I think he'll be recognized as one of the heroes of the church. He was one of the first ones to stand up and say that what was going on in Vatican II was absolutely wrong. Absolutely incredible person. And Intro Ebo is here to tell us more about him today. Intro Ebo, thank you as always for coming on, and I'll hand it over to you. What stories are you going to tell us today about the great Father DePaul?
Well, thank you, Kevin, for having me. And it's going to be a long time since I've spoken about Father DePaul. As you correctly said, that was our first podcast together. We were doing the theme of the occult, and which is very important. And it was Father DePaul who actually first brought that to my attention, which I'll be talking about today as well. But three stories, basically. For those who want to know more about Father DePaul and my art and his the way he came out in defense of the church, go back to that first podcast and you'll hear all about it and how I got to meet him. I was blessed to know him from the time of my conversion from the Vatican II sect into the true church in 1981 when I was 16 years old. Okay, so I met him on August the 9th. I became a traditionalist August the 9th of 1981. I became a traditionalist on the Feast of All Saints, November 1st of 1981, and I was with him until his holy death on May 6th of the year 2005. That was a long time with him, and I have many correspondences, time spent with him, and a lot of interesting things, to say the least, happened in his life, and I was glad to be a part of some of that and the stories that he told me. It was most intriguing to be with him because, unlike when you read a book, you read books about stories about people at the Second Vatican Council. I mean, this was a man who was there. He was a living, walking history book. He knew Cardinal Ottaviani. He knew Montini. He knew Roncalli. He knew, you list it, and any of the characters of the Second Vatican Council, he knew these people. Yeah. And he had personal stories with them. And no book, no secondhand source can ever compete with that. And he was the first, the very first. I did a post called The First, that he was the very first to come out on December 31st, 1964, in open opposition to Vatican II while it was still going on. And he operated the Ave Maria Chapel, which father had inherited a lot of money from his father, Rene DePaul, Desiree DePaul. Desiree DePaul was an educator, which paid a lot of money because, remember, there was no separation of church and state in Belgium. It was a Catholic country. And he was also an attorney and the leader of the Catholic social movement there. So he had quite the bit of money. He made his son, he gave him his blessing, of course, to become a priest. And he said that you are never to take, he says, you have to promise me. And he never explained himself. You have to promise me you'll never take a single dime for mass stipends or for doing the sacraments. He says, and I will take care of you.
Wow.
And when he did, he received he received in American dollars at that time, $800,000, which is a lot of money. And with that, he bought the Ave Maria Chapel, which was a Ukrainian Orthodox chapel. The Ukrainian Orthodox bishop had built a big cathedral in northern New Jersey. He was just interested in getting rid of it. So he offered it, says, if you can pay cash, I'll give it to you for $38,000. And Father bought it all cash. And the first bishop to come out was not Archbishop Lefebvre or Archbishop Tuck or Bishop Mendez or any of the other names that we hear, but was actually Bishop Blaise Kurz, who was bishop moderator of the Catholic traditionalist movement. He was the one who consecrated it on August 10th, 1968, as a traditionalist Catholic chapel. And Bishop Kurz himself was from Germany, West Germany. He was the only Rhineland bishop not to be a modernist and to oppose the modernists. And he was the one who consecrated the chapel and operated from there from 1968 until 2005.
I'm really glad you bring up Bishop Kurz because he's another one of these truly unsung heroes that you always hear about Archbishop Tuck, you hear about Archbishop Lefebvre, but you don't hear about about Bishop Kurz. And it's an interesting thing. I don't actually know why that is. I suppose he didn't leave quite the legacy. He didn't go and ordain as many priests or found any, at least as I am aware, he didn't find any seminaries or whatnot. But he is another one who is, as you say, one of the very first ones to stand up and say, hey, nope. This is no longer the Catholic Church. We can't do this kind of type of stuff. Really, another hero.
In 1966, he stood up. He stood up for Father Lepore, but he never offered the Novus Bogus or any of that. Neither did Father Lepore. Bishop Kurz was famous for saying that. He says, the greatest thing I did was something I never did. I never used the Novus Bogus. That's, wow. Yeah. So what I've done is I've picked three stories. There's many, but I picked three stories that have a good theme, I think, and some you can take food for thought away from each of them. And these are events that have taken place. So the first one has to do with the danger of what I call being an apparitionist. And this comes from an apparitionist is somebody who, now Father DePaul was a big promoter of Our Lady of Fatima, the messages at Fatima, first Saturdays, wearing the scapula, all of that, and about the third secret as well. His brother, Father Adhemar, was actually, his older brother was a Franciscan priest and was actually frequently called by the Holy Office to do investigations. He, like his brother, Father Paul was an approved canonist. His brother was also highly educated and was sent in to do many things, and his brother also said that the third secret had to do with the destruction of the Roman Catholic Church or the alleged attempt at the destruction of the Roman Catholic Church and what would happen after Vatican II, which is why Roncalli never revealed it. But in spite of all this, Father had a very, very good mindset about apparitions and people who put too much emphasis or stock in it as if the faith depends on a particular apparition. There are many, many dangers involved with apparitions. Now, I remember sitting in church and the chapel there back in the 1980s. I remember this is before the time of the internet, and there were people who would come in, and I don't know how these rumors got started, but there were people who would come in, and as I was leaving, they would come to one of the ushers and say, where's the statue of Mary that cries? Mm-hmm. And it's like they were looking for miracles. People would come here and look for miracles. Mm-hmm. And he was stumped. He's like, what are you talking about? He says, there are no statues that cry here. And she goes, well, if it's a real Catholic church, well, then you should have these things. So the father gave, took to the pulpit, and he said, look, he says, and I wrote that this was funny. He said, if you ever want to invite somebody here, somebody wants to come here, please tell them the following. The statues don't cry. The crucifix doesn't bleed. And the white bird you see circling over the chapel isn't a dove, which is the Holy Ghost. It's just a seagull that got lost from the beach. The real miracle that takes place here is the miracle of having preserved the true faith and the graces that come from the Mass and the sacraments. That's the correct Catholic attitude. Now, he had gotten a visit in 1985 from a 17-year-old who identified himself as a cardinal, coming in full regalia and wanting him to address him as Your Eminence. So I asked him, what did you do? And he looked at me, he gave me one of those, you know, really sarcastic, he goes, as if, yeah, I'm really going to call him that. And he was like, well, he says, let me put it this way. Before I slammed the door in his face, I called him something I can't repeat in polite company. So he was from the Palma de Troia cult. Now, Palma de Troia, just so you have some background before I launch into the story itself, it's a story behind the story. This is connected to, guess what, an apparition. And whether or not this apparition was of demonic origin or just charlatans or a combination thereof, it's dangerous. So this has to do with, you know, how do we get a pope back kind of idea. Of course, there's the imperfect general council that was talked about by approved theologians. You have the material formal pope of the Sedi Privationists. I'm certainly open to that, although I'm a garden variety Sedi Vacantist. It could be true. And then you have those who believe in divine intervention. That's a very small minority who spoke about that. But you just don't go run out and elect the pope. I mean, Teresa Benz was a good example of that. The home aloner was back home alone again and decided that, you know, that she and two nice people, along with David Bowden and his mommy and daddy, were going to elect him the pope. It just doesn't work that way.
And real quickly, I do have to do a mention that we're actually going to record a podcast about the issues of home alone-ism with Father Benedict Hughes of the CMRI. We're recording that on Wednesday. So for those who are interested in that topic, more to come in the coming weeks, because it's unfortunately more prevalent than we would think. But anyway, yeah, please continue.
So, well, Mrs. Benz that wasn't from an apparition. That was just from someone who's clueless. And when I excoriated her in one of my posts for leading people into this, you know, 100 people or so were following this guy, who, by the way, his successor is a so-called bishop of dubious orders, who now calls himself Pope Michael II, and it's been found out that when he was a priest, he was involved in a sex scandal. So, yeah, wonderful. And she led these people here. And you know, when I was saying, you know, how ridiculous it is that six people, someone's mommy, his daddy, and a couple of nice people can be elected at the farmhouse. And she corrected me by saying it wasn't a farmhouse, it was a storefront. I'm like, oh, why didn't you say so?
Well,
you
know, in that case.
Yeah, well, come on, you know, that's the second coming of Thomas Aquinas. So, but unlike her, the Palma de Troia cult originated with an apparition. And in March of 1968, a group of people there began claiming supernatural revelations and apparitions of the Blessed Mother. And the apparitions involved four preteen girls, Ana Aguilera, Ana Garcia, Rafaela Gordo, and Josefa Guzman. And they said they saw Mary while picking flowers one day, that she appeared to them. And the locals went to the spot of the miracle, and there were lots of strange phenomena claimed to have taken place, which is suggestive of demonic activity. For example, a local woman who seemed to glow from within, whatever that means. A man who ran around on his knees at an incredible speed. Why you would need to do that, I don't know. Alleged Eucharistic hosts materializing on people's tongues out of nowhere while they were talking. And miraculous healings. Well, whether or not they were really sick and healed is another question. So the Blessed Virgin was supposedly giving these messages regarding the Antichrist, the coming of the Antichrist and the problems in the church. And a man named Clemente Dominguez became the official seer, so to speak, of Palma de Troya. And he claimed to have received the stigmata of the wounds of Christ. Now, I have, they actually had come to me when I was growing up, to my apartment, and they gave me some pictures. Now, I can't tell you how fake this was. It was, you know, it was like literally like somebody has just been handling a hot dog and had the ketchup smeared on his hands. You could see it was squirted ketchup.
Oh, man.
You're like, oh, no, you have to, because this wasn't, you know, digital photography or anything. This was Polaroids. I'm like, the man squirted ketchup. I was, you know, I was a kid and I knew that. So, but these are the types of things. So he had the stigmata and quote unquote, and he attracted quite a following, including some very wealthy people who contributed large sums of money, which goes back to P.T. Barnum, there's a sucker born every minute. And Archbishop Peter Tuck went there and he ordained and consecrated Dominguez and four of his friends as priests and bishops using the traditional rite of the church in January of 76. Now, this is often used by opponents of the Tucks, the Tuck bishops, to say, well, see, he was crazy. Why would he do this? But as Father DePort told me, get this, it was actually Archbishop Lefebvre who believed the story.
I've heard that too. I've heard that he sent them to Archbishop Tuck. Yeah.
Yes. And through one of his priests, one of his spokesman priests, so to speak, told them to go to Archbishop Peter Tuck. And that's why he went, because, well, if Archbishop Lefebvre finds it credulous, then I'll go. And they may have given a good line, and that's how it all happened. I do not accept anything that descends from these people, from the Palma, as being valid. For example, Clemente Dominguez was an illiterate chicken farmer. Okay, there's no way that he could possibly, validly go and consecrate and ordain other people for reasons that should be obvious. When it comes to the Tuck line through Gerard Delorier, or from Carmona, who was also a pre-Vatican II theologian and head of the Acapulco Seminary, those are absolutely valid, but not from these particular people. And so Dominguez didn't understand Latin. He had no formal training. So Mary conveniently told him that Spanish was God's favorite language after Latin, and Spanish could be used in everything. Wow. Okay, great timing for that. And so he translated everything. Now, remember, he doesn't know Latin, but he translated everything into Spanish. So right there, that validates everything. And there's no church approval. You can't be certain of anything. And he lost both his eyes in a car crash. And he had a very strange look about him.
He did.
And he said that he would become, when Paul VI died, he would become Gregory the 17th. And God would publicly restore his sight on television, worldwide television, proving that he was the Pope. We all know that didn't happen as he went to judgment in 2005. And then he said Mary revealed to him what some people have called the crooked ears theory, which is very, you know, you could make a movie about this. So Montini, Paul VI, was a good and holy Pope, but had been drugged and locked up in a closet. I'm trying not to laugh as I say this. Shortly after he was elected by Freemasons, who had taken over and decided they were going to just, I don't know, grab him, you know, inject him full of drugs and throw him in a closet. And they had one of their own replaced by using plastic surgery to look just like him. And that's how Vatican II was promulgated. And they showed me the photos, which allegedly prove this is true, because if you see anything after January 1964, which was the last time that he was, before he got drugged and thrown in a closet, after that, you'll see that the ears are crooked. It was an imperfection they forgot during the plastic surgery, and that proves that this is true. Okay. I also have a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn, but that's another story. So after Montini died, Dominguez was mystically crowned Pope by Christ himself, and he called the first Palmarian Ecumenical Council. Now, things got super weird, if you think they were weird at this point. Every priest in his sect, quote-unquote, was also became a bishop. They would no longer be priests, they'd just be bishops. And since Dominguez had no training and attempted to translate the rites into Spanish, of course, everything is dubious anyway. But he declared that Palma de Troia and not Rome is the seat of the church, but the Pope must always be Bishop of Rome. So there's the heresy right there. In its Palmarian creed that came out of that council declared Mary the irredeemed, for she who was without sin had no need of redemption, which again is pure heresy. But Pius IX, in his declaration at Nephopolis Days of the Immaculate Conception, said that Mary was redeemed in view of the merits of Jesus Christ in a unique manner prior to his death, which God knew with certainty, of course, would happen. And so, you know, this has gone on now. So there was also revelations, by the way, even with no eyes, to show you how creepy the guy was. It has now been admitted that he had several sexual affairs with the nuns. And nevertheless, he was canonized, so-called, as Pope St. Gregory the 17th, the Very Great. And today they have, according to the figures I was able to ascertain, about 1,500 people worldwide. So this was one of his, at that time, cardinals who wanted to make Father DeBoer a cardinal in this ridiculous cult. So Father then launched into a story where he says, I've run into this kind of things before. Now, this event took place in the year 1966, and the Robert Council had just ended, and he was flying around the United States giving talks to large crowds of people, urging them to stay away from the Reformed conciliar establishment, as he called it, and the Novus Bogus so-called Mass. And he was trying to convince people to give his literature to every priest they knew and to hold to the true faith in Mass with priests who rejected the Reforms. And he was always trying to see if priests would join him. And he was in Chicago this particular time, and he had just finished giving a talk about the problems in the church and everything that was going on, and to hold fast to the traditions, etc., in a large hotel room. And he always ended with a question and answer session, but refused to see people individually, as just most of them wanted to argue with him and call him disobedient and schismatic and all kinds of names. But he made one exception to that rule. He would never refuse to talk to a true Catholic priest from any diocese or any religious order who wanted to talk to him. And he was hoping that the priest wanted to join him or could be convinced to do so. So if a priest came, yes, he would see him and talk to him in private. So the hotel manager informed Father that a priest of the Archdiocese of Chicago wanted to see him in the lobby in private. And so Father said he would go and he would speak with him. So I've redacted the names here. I don't know. I don't want these to be revealed. It was told to me in confidence. So yes, I have the names, but I'm not going to say the names of the priest. Okay. So in the lobby, Father DeBoer was greeted by, I'm going to call him Father X, who was 60 years old at the time. So unquestionably validly ordained priest. And standing with the priest was a very modestly dressed and attractive woman in her mid-40s, who I'll call Mrs. Y. She was a married woman. And the woman introduced herself to Father DeBoer and told him that Father X was her confessor and spiritual advisor. And Father said, well, you know, that's very nice, but why are you here with Father X? He wanted to speak to me, and why are you even here? And Father wasn't prepared for what she said next. She says, I have visions and get messages from the Blessed Virgin Mary. So stunned as if she didn't look like she was unstable, he looks to Father X. And he's shaking his head up and down. Yes. And he says, yes, she does, Father DeBoer. She has visions and apparitions. I'll vouch for that. So he asked, why are you in Chicago telling me this instead of at the Vatican or explaining this to Archbishop Cody, who was the Archbishop of Chicago at the time and would be made a so-called Cardinal by Montini the year after, in 1967. And Father really wasn't prepared for what they said next. So Father X said, because this message is for you personally from the Blessed Virgin Mary, and we were told to come and give it to you in person. So Father says, all right, what is this alleged message? And Mrs. Y said, Paul VI has been stripped of the papacy, and you've been mystically anointed pope in his place, Your Holiness. What will be your regnal name? So Father DeBoer immediately said, do not call me Your Holiness. I am not the Pope, and I'm not taking a regnal name. He says, this is nonsense. And Father X says, Our Lady will not take no for an answer. And Father said, I'm not saying no to the Blessed Virgin Mary, only to you two, because I think you need to see a psychiatrist. And he said, certainly God and his mother would inform me if this took place. They're not going to send, you know, first of all, and he says, even going beyond that, he castigated the priest, his father asked, for believing something contrary to Catholic theology. As a priest, he should know better than to believe in secretly divinely chosen popes. There's nothing that supports that in Catholic theology. And as an approved canonist, he knew this, Father DePaul, better than an ordinary priest. But still, with his seminary training, no priest ordained back in the 1930s, right? Early 1930s. He should be buying into this nonsense. So he said, look, he says, I think this meeting is over. It's been nice meeting you, Father. I hope you go back and reread your theology books. I'm going back to work with the Catholic traditionalist movement. I hope you come to your senses, and I hope you reject the new conciliar faith, which is a false church. And he said, we will not leave you alone until you announce to the world your pope. So he says, you'll be waiting forever, because that's not happening. Now, for the next 10 months, get this, for the next 10 months. Now, he was going all over the United States, into Canada. He even made a couple of trips into Europe, mostly here in North America. But everywhere he went, Father X and Mrs. Y showed up at every talk, sitting in the back row staring at him, waiting for him to make his so-called announcement. Now he started to get worried, and people started saying to him, you know, people who were near to Father DePaul saying, you know, this is stalking. Who knows what these people are going to do to you? You know, all right, he's a priest, but, you know, doesn't he have, you know, what's he doing flying around the country with you? Shouldn't he be at his, you know, where is he stationed? What is he doing? Where's his parish? So it was starting to worry him, because he says it was creepy. It was creepy seeing these people come in every time, and the lady was always dressed the same. Always dressed the same. It was like she never changed her, you know, she was nicely dressed, but it was always like a uniform type thing. And they'd always sit there and stare, and they stared the entire time. They never took their eyes off him. So he was going to go get a restraining order, but he didn't want to get the priest in trouble unnecessarily. He gave, like, he gave a professional courtesy, if you want to call it that, to another priest. So he called the chancery in Chicago, and he called the chancery and he said to tell them about Father X's behavior and to order him to stop his stalking and to him and the woman to stay away, or he would take legal action. And it wouldn't look good to have a priest with a restraining order on him. And eerily, the day before Father called, he was told on the phone, because they actually passed him. They passed him to the personal secretary of the archbishop. And he said the day before, he packs his belongings. Father X packed all his belongings, left the rectory without a trace, leaving only a short note saying he would never be back. And later, it was discovered a few months later, it was told to him through a source that Mrs. Y and her husband sold their house and were never heard from again. No one knows. They left no forwarding address, no information. And he never heard from either of them again. And the Archdiocese of Chicago, because he checked up on it a few years later, just out of his own curiosity, never heard from Father X again after he had been a priest, I'm going to say, a good 30 years.
Wow.
Okay. And he said to me, he says, can you imagine the damage to the church I would have caused had I fallen for such a ridiculous story?
Huh.
He says, hey, you imagine if I had stood up and said, you know, I'm Pope Gomar the First or some nonsense? And he said, we must know Catholic theology and never abandon it. That's the means by which God preserves the one true faith. Not through apparitions, not through secret messages. You know, no matter how sincere the people may be, that's not how God operates.
And it's great. I mean, I love that part of the faith, that it's something that is reasonable, right? You can come to it through reason and through practicality, and someone with such common sense, obviously someone who had studied, you know, actual law, you know, a church law, obviously could see that, you know, that pure nonsense. But what's beautiful about it too is that with our faith, that every man and woman and child can also have that same reason and say, yeah, if you've studied just the basic catechism, you just understand the basics of the faith, you can say, wait, no, you can't do that. And that's the incredible thing about Vatican II, right? That, I mean, really, if you just know the faith preached before 1960, you can say, oh, no, well, you can't do that, right? And that's the beauty of it, I suppose, that unfortunately, millions of people, well, they didn't see.
That's right. And yeah, Father told me too, at that point, he showed me that the last prayer, you know, he prayed more than most priests did even before Vatican II. He was very diligent in his prayers. And the last one was one that he made. It was his own prayer then. And he just wrote it down because the verbiage came to him and he just liked the way it sounded. And he would say it every night. He says, this summarizes what I, so he wrote it down for me and he handed it to me. And he said, Lord, you know I've done my best today to keep and spread the faith. It is thy church. I'm going to sleep now. I trust in thee, that thou shalt ever take care of her. Amen. That's how he ended his night. That was the first story, the dangers of apparitions and becoming overly involved and getting away from approved theologians and what the church actually teaches. So that story held that back to me, it really sent that home to me, that message home to me. And it was really creepy. Lord only knows what that priest and that woman were up to. And
bizarre.
It is very, very much so. The second story is what I like to call a story about subtle miracles. Now, that's my own expression, by the way. This is not something from approved theologians. This is not something you're going to find in a catechism or any official teaching of the church. I want to make that clear. Okay? I don't want anyone coming away saying there's such a thing as subtle miracles. No, there's not. All right. That's just a term that I'm coining and using. And what it really is, it's, there are, as a Catholic, you have to believe in the possibility and the actuality of miracles. Miracles can and do happen. That is of divine and Catholic faith. As a matter of fact, it's in the anti-modernist oath that every priest had to swear to beginning in 1910. It was composed by His Holiness Pope St. Pius X. So we know that miracles can and do happen. Very few of us experience one of these overt miracles or an actual miracle. A healing at Lourdes or, whatever type of, a storm calming suddenly, maybe if you're in danger in the sea or something like that. We have to believe that the miracles in the Bible are literally true. They are not allegories. They're not stories or fables. These literally happened. Water changed into wine. That's a fact. Lazarus literally was dead and came back to life. That's a fact. Those are miracles. You must believe in those. Now, when the church approves of miracles, say Lourdes, or approves of miracles like the miracle of the sun, you should believe in them. You should. But it is not, if you didn't believe in those particular miracles, you wouldn't commit a sin against the faith. And if you're, for example, I'm just making this up, but if a colleague of mine at work said, Jesus Christ appeared to me in my home and snapped his fingers and the water changed into wine, I don't have to believe that at all. As a matter of fact, the people I work with, I wouldn't. I'd probably think the wine was there first and that's where he saw Christ afterwards. But that's the teaching on miracles. Those are actual miracles, and very few of us in our lives will be so graced as to actually experience one. But there are those subtle miracles which show how providence works. Now, these are not something that's going to, you're going to go and say, all right, I have to speak to somebody, even if it was, pre-Vatican II, it's not something where you're going to go and speak to somebody in the Curia of Pope Pius XII and say, look, this, but it's something that brings home the fact that God is in charge and things are going to work out. And a good example of that comes to my mind, there's a great movie by Mel Gibson called Signs, if anyone sees it, and it shows, how everything comes together to show that there is a purpose behind things. So the year was 1989, and there was a 42-year-old man jogging on Long Island on the North Shore, and he was a car went out of control, hit him, and he was in critical injury at a hospital. There's two major hospitals at that time in Nassau County, and he went to one of them. And no one really knew about this at the time, you know, that this had just happened. Father Poe received a call from one of the parishioners whose aunt had just died, and they wanted him to go and anoint the body. So he'd agreed to do it. He says, "Where is she?" And he says, "I couldn't make it. There's all this crackling noise." And he mentioned one of the hospitals. The hospital is further away from the chapel. And why would she be there? Why would she take him there? It didn't make sense. Couldn't hear well. He kept saying, "Are you sure she's there?" "Yes, yes, yes." All right. So he hangs up. And he didn't want to go to this particular hospital, but he, of course, he was, because father already in his 70s, they did away in the late 80s with clergy parking. And so they made these poor priests and other clergymen walk regardless of age. So he went there and he had to park all the way, you know, in the boondocks, so to speak, and walk quite a bit at his age to the hospital. So he asks if he could anoint the body of the woman. And they looked at him and they said, "We're sorry, Father, but there's nobody here by that name." So he says, "What do you mean?" He says, "There's no, I'm seriously, because could you please," they wouldn't lie to me. He says, "Well, we're not lying to you either. It's not here." So he asked if he could use the phone and he called the other hospital. And she was at the hospital that's closer to the chapel. So now he says, "I can't believe it." So he says, "I must have been talking out loud." He says, "You know, why, oh God, do you bring me here?" You know, he says, "I've got heart problems." Well, Nassau County, Long Island is broken into two counties, Nassau and Suffolk. And Nassau County is where Ave Maria Chapel is located. He goes, they must have heard me speaking out loud because the Nassau County police sergeant happened to be there in the lobby. And he came over. He says, "Father, is everything okay?" So he explained to him. He says, "You know, I had to park all the way there, and I'm just frustrated." And he goes, "Oh, Father, I think that's horrible." He says, "Look," he says, "I'm going to take my squad car. I'm going to go out and get my squad car. Stand in the front. You get in. He says, I'm going to give you a police escort back to your car." He says, "No one's going to say no to me." He goes, "Oh, thank you so much." He goes, "And then you go drive and anoint the body." So as he's walking, a woman, approximately 40 years old, comes after him and says, "Excuse me, sir, excuse me, are you a Roman Catholic priest?" He says, "I certainly am." She says, "Oh, thank God I found you." She said, the chaplain turned off his, can't be found, and he turned off his pager. And he didn't want to be bothered, and my husband's in immediate danger of death. He was hit by a car. He's touch and go. Would you please give him the last rites? Now, in 1989, most of the people were raised still in the true church, and they didn't really understand. They thought they were Catholic. So Father would do those things. So he told the nice police sergeant, "Go ahead without me, and I have to deal with this." So he went, and he gave it, and he said the minute he finished giving the final apostolic benediction blessing and going into the final prayers, he had finished praying over him, made the sign of the cross, and he went cold blue instantly.
Wow.
So they came running in, and they worked on him for a long time, over a half hour, and he was pronounced dead. So then he went and anointed the body at the other hospital, came back, he was exhausted, calls them up, and he says, "Why did you tell me the wrong hospital?" And they said, "We didn't. Because we kept telling you that she was there, but you kept saying, why are you sure that she's there?" And we kept telling him, "Father, no, he said, but we thought you had problems with your hearing or something." He says, "You didn't tell me to go there." He says, "No." "Okay." He says, "That was the first thing." And then a month later, he gets a letter in the mail made to him, care of the Catholic Traditionalist Movement, Ave Maria Chapel. And it's from the wife of the deceased jogger. And in it, she had a very generous donation to the CTM and thanked him for what he had done. And she, the letter was quite moving and said that, you know, my husband was never, was never the best Catholic, but, you know, he was a good husband, and he was basically a good guy. And when he made his first Holy Communion, his aunt gave him this prayer card. And she told him that if he said the prayer every day, that everything would work out all right for him in the end, if he really believed and tried his hardest to be good. So she says, now that he's gone, he probably want you to have it, because I don't know what else, you know, for what you did for him. So with the check, that was included. And she said, no matter where we were, no matter what we were doing, even when we were on vacation, he kept it in his wallet. And it was never off his person. It was always somewhere on him. The last thing he would do before he went to sleep to get down, and he was doing this since the age of 7 when he made his first Holy Communion, was make the sign of the cross, pray this short prayer, make the sign of the cross, and then go to sleep. And he wouldn't go to sleep if he hadn't said the prayer. And the prayer, which I wrote down, is this. Lord Jesus Christ, I beg of thee through the intercession of thy most immaculate mother, to grant me the great grace of final perseverance. May a priest of thy one true church give me the last rites before I die. Amen. Oh. And he said he had to suppress a shudder that was going down his spine because, as you know, those prayer cards pre-Vatican II all had an imprimatur and a nihil obstat that had to be given by a bishop. And it was a bishop he knew very well when he came here to the United States. It was Archbishop, it was before he got promoted to cardinal, it was Archbishop Cook. Actually, not Cook, that came after, but Cook was a bad guy. Archbishop Spellman. It was Francis Spellman. And the date given of the imprimatur, because it was an old, it was a beautiful card. It was had a picture of Sacred Heart of Jesus and the Immaculate Heart of Mary in the front and the prayer on the back. And it was, you know, it was brown with age around the edges. And the date of the imprimatur was April 12th, 1942. Father DePaul was ordained on April 12th, 1942.
Wow. That's incredible. Boy, wow.
So, coincidence, again, you draw your own conclusions. I've drawn mine.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah, but what can I say? I got some goosebumps from that one. That's incredible. What? Wow. That's amazing. But talk about, hey, what more do you need to say about perseverance and prayer?
Incredible. Right. Perseverance, prayer, providence, God's providence.
Wow.
You know, and that the subtle miracle, as I like to call it, you know, things that happen in our life that show you that God's in charge without it having to be the miracle of the sun or, you know, somebody being raised from the dead. It doesn't have to be to that actual miracle status to show you that God is still there.
And absolutely.
That was the point of that story.
Wow. Beautiful.
And the last one I'm going to share today was about a Sunday I would never forget. Is when I arrived at approximately 8:30 for the 9 a.m. Holy Sacrifice of the Mass at the Ave Maria Chapel with my parents. And that was usual for me. And what wasn't usual was what my parents and I witnessed on that balmy summer day in 1987. There was a police helicopter flying low and circling the chapel continuously. And not less than a half a dozen uniformed police were patrolling the chapel grounds, and there were plainclothes detectives at the entrance. So we're thinking that somebody, boy, was anything happened to Father DePaul? Maybe like somebody broke in and, you know, hurt him or, you know, vandalized the chapel. So I didn't know if we could go there. God forbid a vandalization or worse. However, we were allowed to enter. As we reached the front doors, one of the detectives was looking me over because I was 22 at the time and appeared much younger. And he asked my parents, is this young man your son? And they said, yes, he is. And they said, all right, three of you can go in. After having, been checked for weapons. Everyone inside was looking rather pensive. And Father was not hearing confessions that Sunday as he did 30 minutes before the first Mass every week. So I knelt down and recited my prayers before Mass and Communion, and when the bell rang and Father DePaul entered the sanctuary, he looked distraught. And the low Mass began, and after reading of the Gospel, Father came to give the announcements and sermon at the pulpit. And with a somber tone in his voice, he told us that the police had come there, and there had been a credible death threat made against him by some people involved in a satanic coven. Now, they said they were going to murder him to show their hatred for Jesus Christ. their hatred for Catholicism and everything that Father DePauw stands for. And all this for the glory of Satan. Now, the police, especially on Long Island, if anyone knows anything about Long Island, they don't react to threats unless they are very serious. So for them to have a helicopter and all these cops and plainclothes, it was serious. This was not some kid playing some stupid prank. They didn't come out for that. If you were lucky, you'd get one cop to come and just look the place over and then they'd leave. That was their modus operandi. So the fact that this was taking place, it was some serious stuff. And 99% of the time, that's what you got. The 1% they didn't, you had to worry. So now I'm sitting there and I'm worried. So, but Father assured us we were not in any danger. The police had secured the grounds and checked for explosives and such. They remained in case someone would pose as a visitor with the intent of making good on the threat to murder him. And when the police suggested that perhaps he should shut down, because this actually happened, you know, before Sunday, obviously. And they suggested he should shut down the chapel for a few weeks and get out of town and take up residence with another traditional priest, friend of his, because he had a very good friend in Chicago, speaking of, not Father X. And Father balked at the idea. He said, if they kill me in hatred of the true faith, I would die a martyr at the altar. I can think of no better way for a priest to die. He says, but I'm not worried. My patron, St. Michael the Archangel, beat Satan before, and he'll do it again. So don't be dumb. Nice. Don't be afraid. And a defiant and faith-filled Father DePauw was there at the pulpit and told us about what was, that Satan should not be feared, only fought. And he completed the Mass slowly, reverently, as he always did. And we left breathing a little easier. Nothing happened to Father. And he was told by the police and DA not to discuss the specifics of the event, which he didn't. The following week, things went back to normal. No more helicopters like that. And a big, big sigh of relief. Now, this was the 1980s, was a time here in the United States of the so-called Satanic Panic, is actually what it's called. You can look that up. And it swept the United States. And there were false and exaggerated claims of what's called Satanic Ritual Abuse, or SRA. And it seemed to culminate with the famous broadcast on October 22nd, 1988, with the show Devil Worship Exposing Satan's Underground, presented by Geraldo Rivera. And I watched the show the night that it aired, and it was sensationalistic in the extreme. The show would be one of the most highly viewed documentaries of all time, and at that time it was number one. And to this day, it's still, I think, in the top 20. The media and the secularists want us to think that the idea of people following Satan is nonsense in all cases. And the fundamentalist Protestants want us to see the devil everywhere we look without exception. So, as always, in medio stat veritas, in the middle lies the truth. And this story says that it's the true. This was Father DePauw brought out the rise in the occult, the rise in paganism, and the rise in actual satanic worship, which was going on. He said not to be deceived when they're telling you that it's not taking place. Sure, there were people who were making stuff up, and it was exaggerated, but was not nearly exaggerated to the point where they're making you think that it was. It wasn't a true panic where people were just, making stuff up. Some were, but the most were not. And he told me it's going to get exponentially worse, and I've witnessed that in my lifetime, as my series on the occult with you clearly shows. So there are those who serve Satan knowingly and willingly, and those who serve him indirectly. For example, I've been on your show speaking about the occult. The vast majority, I'm going to go as far as to say 95% of people who practice yoga are not Satan worshipers.
Right.
They have no idea of worshiping Satan. A lot of them would actually be insulted if you even suggested that. Well, yeah, I would never do that. And they wouldn't. But they're involved in an occult practice which can lead them down unwittingly to do satanic things, get involved in pagan satanic things. But there are those who, again, who do it willingly and those who are fooled. The scripture tells us Satan himself transformeth himself into an angel of light in 2 Corinthians, right? But according to the New York Times, this is interesting, how prescient Father DePaul was. It said, quote, it is unclear how many Wiccans, and a Wicca is the official name of witches. Okay, Wiccan is the religion, and they're called, and it's not, men are not called warlocks and women are, witches are for both men and women. It's unclear how many Wiccans and other pagans there are. The 2001 American Religious Identification Survey given by the City University of New York found that Wicca was the country's fastest growing religion with 134,000 adherents compared with approximately 8,000 in 1990. Now, when Father was talking to me about this, it was 1987. So there was just under 8,000 adherents at that time. All right. So let's say 1990. All right. So 1990, and in 21 years, it grew from 8,000 to 134,000. That's exponential growth. It's not like there was 8,000, now there's 10,000. 8,000 to 134,000. It continues. The actual number may be greater. Some people may have been unwilling to identify themselves as pagan or Wiccan for the survey. Others combine paganism with other religions. And that was published in May 16th of 2007, talking about the 2001 survey. As to those who identify as pagans, pagans being polytheistic, animistic, or pantheistic pre-Christian religions, some studies suggest that there are at least 1.2 million pagans living in the United States right now. Pew Forum on Religion and the Public Life says that there are 1.5 million Hindus, 1.2 million Buddhists, 3.45 million Mohammedans. Right? The fact that there are currently millions of witches, animists, and other pagans in the country is reason enough for genuine concern. Even the Bible says, quote, but the things which the heathen sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils and not to God. And I would not that you should be made partakers with devils, unquote. That's 1 Corinthians 10:20. So don't forget that Pope Pius XI clearly establishes Islam as dark, the darkness of idolatry and of Islamism. So that's evil. And he puts that in the dedication of the human race to the most sacred heart of Jesus. Now, the growth of these religions allow for greater demonic activity. Yet the Vatican II sect says, quote, Nostra Aetate, paragraph number 2 and number 3. The church therefore exerts her sons that through dialogue and collaboration with the followers of other pagan religions, pagan is added, other religions, meaning pagan religions, carried out with prudence and love and in witness to the Christian faith and life, they recognize, preserve, and promote the good things, spiritual and moral, as well as the sociocultural values found among these men. The church regards with esteem also the Muslims. It noticed the absence of any mention to convert them to the one true church, and it goes right along with Bergoglio. Proselytism is solemn nonsense. There is no Catholic God. Right? Good people who are raised in the sect thinking they are Catholic come to accept rather than reject paganism. One of the major reasons, Father alerted me to this fact, that is allowing them to say, well, it's not that big of a deal. So the main rise, he gave me what he called the institutional reasons and the acute reasons. The institutional reasons go to, of course, Vatican II. And the main rise, the main cause of the rise in paganism and occultism, the occult explosion, the occult invasion, and even Satanism itself goes back to three things. The false ecclesiology of Vatican II. The heretical ecclesiology that tells us the Church of Christ is distinct from the Roman Catholic Church, but subsists there because it has all the elements of the Church of Christ. The Church of Christ and the Roman Catholic Church are no longer one and the same thing. The Church of Christ subsists there, but it also subsists in other places, depending on how many elements it has. So to have all the elements is best, but just having some elements is good too and leads to salvation. That's in Lumen Gentium of Vatican II. This explains why Nostra Aetate, which I just cited to you, could praise the false and diabolical sects of Hinduism and their demonic gods, or demon gods, literally demons, Buddhism, and Islam. It also explains how so-called Saint Wotila, you know, John Paul II, could kiss the evil Quran because it contains some elements of truth. I wonder if that's a second-class relic now. You realize that, right? He's a saint and he kissed it? Can we have to venerate that as a second-class relic? All right. Now, but listen, Kevin, using that exact same reason, right? Using that exact same line of thinking, well, let's kiss the Satanic Bible. That has some truth in it, doesn't it? Same thing exists, right? So let's kiss the Satanic Bible. Makes sense, doesn't it? Well, no, unless you buy into this perverse and false heretical nonsense. So you'll frequently hear Vatican II sect clergy talking about baptism bringing someone into full communion within the sect. Well, that if there's full communion, it implies there's partial communion. But it's blatantly heretical. You can't be partially Catholic any more than you can be partially dead. You're either dead or you're not. I was going to say partially pregnant, but now, believe it or not, there's a New York State constitutional amendment coming up this year. I kid you not, to protect all 58 genders and pregnant persons, not women, persons. There's some mentally ill person who thinks that they're some mentally sick woman who thinks that she's a man and gets pregnant. You have a pregnant man.
But see, I'm glad you bring that up real quick, because I think that it's so prevalent in what we hear in the news and stuff, this crazy transgenderism and stuff. And I think it's a vast minority of people who have these things, but I think it's very clearly shows you the touch of the devil, you know, I really, truly satanic type stuff, because it truly is this mockery of God, mockery of human kind. I mean, it's really incredible. I mean, and when you really think about it, okay, well, who would do that? I mean, of course it's the devil. And I think as you mentioned before, you know, so many of the things that we do and that we watch and that we allow, you know, as you say, you know, hey, if I'm a Novus Ordo Catholic and I can just, you know, go and hug a Hindu at some point, well, you know, okay, great. Why not? And I think that this type of stuff absolutely does just open the gates for Satan. And well, guys, look at our society. Look at the world. Look what is happening right now. I mean, they murder babies by the millions and then say men or women. I think the devil just might be, you know, kind of running amok at this point.
Absolutely. And that was the point. You know, now, again, I bring up the point of Father's death threat because that's when he started talking to me about all this. And remember the year, again, 1987. 1987 this was. We were, you know, just about 25 years into the Great Apostasy. Not even 23 years. 23 years. Not even a quarter century into the Great Apostasy was happening at this time. And it was beginning to really take off. Things like this, you know, 20 years prior wouldn't have been heard of. And the other reason, you know, that so you have the false ecclesia, you have the religious liberty, Dignitatis Humanae, which says that, quote, the Vatican Synod declares that the human person has a right to religious freedom. This freedom means that all men are to be immune from coercion on the part of individuals or societal groups or of any other human power in such wise that in matters religious, no one is forced to act in a manner contrary to his own beliefs, nor is anyone to be restrained from acting in accordance with his own belief, whether privately or publicly, whether alone in association with others within due limits. This, of course, coming from John Courtney Murray, who was censured under Pope Pius XII and rehabilitated by Roncalli, who wrote this document. So Vatican II says that no one should be forced to believe, which a church has always taught, you can't force belief on somebody, but also claims no one can be restrained from practicing the religion of their choice, and that will include paganism and the occult and, yes, Satanism itself.
Well, so, and it's just sending people to hell. And that's the incredible thing that we understand that, I mean, we know that only through Christ can one be saved. That's absolutely defined and sure. We know that only Christ and God, will, of course, will judge the individual. But we know that only through Christ you can be saved. So if you're saying otherwise, it's fine. The church, as these people call it, quote unquote, the Novus Ordo church, is sending people to hell. I just through these documents, it is literally just saying, we don't care. We don't go ahead. Yeah, you go to damnation. It's unbelievable. It's so evil. Again, it can only be written by the devil himself.
Exactly. Documents from hell. And the third reason that this had happened was, of course, the false mass and sacraments of the Vatican II sect. Because when the true church was driven underground, so to speak, and the modernists took over the formerly Catholic buildings, they evicted Christ. And when the Mass is replaced by an invalid bread and wine service, the grace that comes to humanity from the unbloody sacrifice of the cross was diminished. And as Christ decreases, Satan increases. There is no vacuum. Satan increases. So why did else did missionaries have to perform so many exorcisms in the foreign lands filled with pagans? You hear about that all, you read about it all the time. They're always performing exorcisms. But as the Mass increased and there were more conversions, the demonic activity decreased. That was necessary. Well, the inverse is also true. So those are the institutional reasons from the Great Apostasy. And in the 1980s, at the time that was going up, just prior, 1984, 3 years prior to that, there was something that shocked the world on Long Island here. The case of, anyone wants to look it up, Ricky Caso, K-A-S-S-O, born Richard Allen Caso Jr. in 1967, was called the Acid King for his use of LSD. He became involved with reading the Satanic Bible. I was listening to satanic rock groups like AC/DC and such. Caso murdered his 17-year-old friend Gary Lawrence in the town of Northport, Long Island, not too far from the Ave Maria Chapel, on June 19, 1984, in a ritualistic satanic slaying. It was ritualistic. And Caso attacked his friend in the woods with two accomplices, stabbing him multiple times and demanding that he say, "I love Satan." But instead, the victim replied, "No, I love my mother," and he bled out. And Caso hid the body under branches and leaves, and he bragged to his friends about the killing, even going so far as taking some to see the decaying corpse and saying that Satan was so pleased with him for the murder, he manifested himself to Caso in the form of a black crow sitting on his windowsill. Oh. So he claimed. The body of the missing Lawrence was discovered by police on July 4th, and Caso was arrested July 6th. He committed suicide in the jail by hanging himself on July 7th. And there's a book on that called Say You Love Satan, published in 1987, the year that this happened, with the Father DePaul. And Caso was an early example of the self-styled Satanists. These are individuals that seek out Satan on their own for power, and they're not affiliated with any formal church or coven. This is in distinction to the Church of Satan founded by Anton LaVey in 1966, or other formal Satanists like the sect called the Temple of Set. Now, one of the biggest lies perpetrated by LaVey was claiming that Satan only represents the forces of nature and wasn't a real entity. Now, in a book published posthumously in 1999, LaVey died in 1997. He admitted in an interview, listen to this, quote, "If they're at all intelligent," and he's talking about other Satanists, "they'll realize there's only so much I can say publicly. I will not advance things in print, which make my position untenable. How long would the Church of Satan have lasted if I hadn't appeased and outraged in just the right combination? It required a certain amount of discretion and diplomacy to balance the outrage," unquote. So, yeah, there are some who believe that it's nature, but not all of them. Not most of them, I would go as far as to say. And the case of Ricky Caso, which I just described and it happened 3 years prior, was shocking at the time that someone so young would become involved with devil worship, but we're now witnessing younger and younger children doing the same. May 31st, 2014, 12-year-olds Morgan Geiser and Anissa Wire admitted they lured their friend Peyton Lutner into the woods near the suburb in Milwaukee Park. Geiser stabbed Lutner 19 times while the other girl urged her on. Lutner was left for dead, but she crawled out of the woods and got help from a passing bicyclist, and they were carrying out the attack to curry favor with the Slender Man, a fictional online horror character typified by spidery limbs and a blank white face, the occult. And that led them to guess what? That led them into looking at satanic rituals in horror movies. Satanic rituals coming in this too. Another one in USA Today. Two girls. This is from 2018. Two girls, ages 11 and 12, whose names were withheld, were found in a bathroom stall at their school, allegedly with multiple knives, a pizza cutter, and a knife sharpener in their possession, planning to commit suicide after stabbing other students and killing them. The plan was to kill at least one student. They were hoping to kill anywhere from 15 to 25 students. Killing all of these students was in the hopes it would make them worse sinners, ensuring they could go, after they committed suicide, to the worst place in hell so they could be with Satan. That's a direct quote from USA Today. Okay. They hatched the plot after after watching scary movies, and guess what else they were reading? Satanic Bible. All right, Rolling Stone magazine quotes the Satanic sect as saying in response to this, "I'm sure it will be established these girls had no active role in any established form of religious Satanism, the major sects of which today are non-theistic, humanistic, and anti-superstitious," said Lucian Greaves, spokesperson and co-founder of the Satanic Temple. "Their distorted perspective of what Satanism is, and their apparent supernatural belief in what Satan wants is almost certainly the product of Christian upbringing, possibly an attempt at the tired devil made us do it nonsense." All right, and that again was from Rolling Stone magazine. Am I the only one to see the media hype doesn't add up in this? Why would middle schoolers seek out violent thrills, especially a type of Satanism, which was not at all according to its teachings? If they're teaching humanistic types of things, you know, where did they get this idea of bloody sacrifice and all this other things? You know, madness isn't contagious. Two people can't dream the same dream. I mentioned this once before on a podcast. You know, I even discussed it with a psychiatrist in Manhattan. He said, "You're right." He said, "You know, I don't know how to explain it," because he was not a believer. He said, "I don't know how to explain it, but two people that, you know, they're trying to say these people are psychotic." How many people together can have psychotic episodes like this? This is not psychotic. This is something that is the rise in the occult, the rise in Satanism, and the rise in paganism, all from Vatican II and from things that are now endemic in our society because of Vatican II. And I'll just go some of the things we had discussed just briefly. The Harry Potter franchise portrays witchcraft in a positive light, promotes moral relativism. Something is only right or wrong depending on what it does and for what reason. The end justifies the means. You're being taught that. Star Wars franchise promotes Eastern pagan pantheism and the impersonal force. May the force be with you instead of may the Lord be with you. Rock, pop, and rap music is rotten to the core. I had the once per month series Singing for Satan about the evils of that. The Twilight franchise promotes evil as good and actually implies statutory rape when you have a 107-year-old with a 16-year-old. Video games desensitizing children to violence, using all kinds of demonic types of icons and characters. So-called mediums, psychics, and ghost whisperers pervade entertainment on TV and are even invited into homes by adults to speak to deceased relatives. Pagan practices like yoga and Reiki promoted not only in public schools, but in the Vatican II sex schools and churches. Horror movies seeped in the occult, showing you literally what you can do. These are not, they don't make up those rituals, by the way. They're actual rituals taken from satanic ritual books and the Satanic Bible. Satanic Bible and Wiccan books are readily available to children in public libraries and schools. They are not put as off limits. And the Vatican II sect tells its members that all religions are more or less good, no need to combat Satan or to convert others. The result? Well, you're seeing it in what's going on today. And Father DePaul was one of the first recipients of that satanic hatred with the death threat against him in 1987, which he stood strong and never came to pass. But that's when I learned and became fascinated with the occult explosion and began, that planted the seeds for me right there and how it needs to be exposed and fought. And those are my three stories by Father DePaul.
Well, I'm really curious what Father DePaul would say about the rise of the internet. You said he died in 2005, so I suppose he was around when the internet was here, obviously, but it would have been still fairly new, because I think that's something that I think obviously is a huge part of this as well. Is that, I mean, as you say, children have all this material at their hands, but look at the internet, for goodness sake. I think that's the, if there's anything that these kids are, you know, just have the devil at their fingertips, literally. I mean, just so many different things. I mean, I think it's a really interesting thing that I listen to politics in the U.S. fairly often, and you hear all these libertarians who, you know, they pretend to be, have traditional conservative values. You know, we should allow everything on the internet. Everything should be allowed. And obviously it's absolute insanity. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, just the allowance of pornography, for example, I mean, and how totally destructive that is to a child's brain, and how, you know, and not just brain, geez, of course their soul, you know, their body, I mean, everything. And And the fact that we allow that as a society, it's like, well, I mean, again, what do we expect? What are we surprised that the devil is running amok? Because we let these things happen. And I think we got to be careful with that when we see in our own lives, whatever we can impact with that. I mean, if it's in politics or our own lives, I mean, for goodness sake, first of all, don't let your kids have cell phones. That's easy. That is, I'm sure you agree with me that's, you just can't. It's insanity in my mind. And I know it's hard to hear, but the evils are just too close. I mean, or at least supervised just absolute to an, a crazy level. But I mean, I think, again, we just have to understand that as you say, Father DePaul was handling this back in 1987. That was before the internet, for goodness sake. I mean, look what we have to deal with now. So let's, and I think I'm so impacted by the story of the man who hopefully, God willing, had his soul saved through intervention, through a subtle miracle, as you say, because he persevered. And he kept praying that prayer, even if he wasn't the best Catholic, the best man, made plenty of mistakes, kept praying the prayer. And I think that's the message. Keep praying. Don't give up on that. And so many stories I've had on just this podcast, pray the rosary. Boy, if you want a miracle in your life when you're going to need it the most, if it probably at your last minutes, go to Our Lady and she'll be the one who's there for you at the end. And that's definitely what we want. And no, I'm as always, Enjoyable, I love having you on. I love the perspective and the stories of a great priest. I greatly appreciate it. I'm really glad. I'm just kind of hoping, like, okay, when can we have three more stories of Father DePaul? No, it's just absolutely beautiful. And again, if anyone's interested in hearing more about Father DePaul, I will link that first podcast we did, boy, maybe 2 years ago. I don't know. It's been a while. I'll try to link that and you can get more of the background kind of who he was. A fascinating character. No, again, thank you so much for the stories. I appreciate it. Everyone out there, persevere, pray, kneel down tonight before you go to bed, say your prayers, and that's how we beat the devil. I tell you, I don't know. Is there another way, Enjoyable? Is there another way to beat the devil?
No, prayer, the sacraments, and perseverance. And the rosary. Amen.
And the rosary. Yep. The rosary, yep. Rosary will save us at the end. That is absolutely certain. Awesome. Enjoyable, thank you so much for coming on, sharing these stories. If anyone liked this, please let us know. Comment on it. I'd actually be interested to hear, listeners out there, what are your subtle miracles? Because these are beautiful stories to me. And again, as Intribo so well said, these are not things you have to believe. These are not, binding to your faith. But to me, they're inspiring because it really does show that God is at work, actually at work in our lives and in the world. So let us know what yours are. I'd be curious to hear them. You can leave them in the comment section or email me, kevin89davis@gmail.com. Who knows? Maybe I'll be able to share it one way or another if it's good enough and interesting enough. But otherwise, go over to enjoyableadultryday2.blogspot.com. There's material every Monday. Fantastic stuff. I can't recommend it enough. We've talked about several of these things before. I mean, you're talking about the crazy Spanish cult, and now I can't even think. Palmer de Troya. Thank you, Palmer de Troya. It reminded me of your article about Garibaldi, which is again just absolutely fantastic. And it just shows you exactly kind of that same idea of, oh boy, be careful when it comes to private revelation. So again, introibo.adultaridei2.blogspot.com. I'm struggling through this. .blogspot.com. And we hope to have you back on. I'm sure we'll continue our series on the occult. No one does it better than you do. And necessary stuff, because the world is a dark place, but well, knowledge will help us a little bit to understand how to make it lighter. Enjoyable. Until next time, God bless you.
Thank you.